We're in the book of Judges, and we are just about to the middle. We're closer to a third than a middle. But anyway, just remember that the theme of this, it's good to remember this periodically, that the theme of the whole book is that Israel becomes like Canaan. Israel becomes like the nations around them. And there's a repeating cycle that goes on over and over again, and each time it gets worse, and the cycle's pretty much the same all the time. Israel does evil in the eyes of the Lord, which means they start to be like the culture around them and worship their gods, and then the Lord gives them over to an oppressor. The people cry out to the Lord, and the Lord sends a deliverer to save them. And the land then has rest for a short time, and then it starts all over again when the people do evil in the eyes of the Lord. And the purpose is not just to tell us what happened, but to tell us with a purpose. And the author's purpose is to speak to and to warn the people of his time, not to become like the people of Israel were, but to repent and be right with the Lord. Don't become like this, lest they too end up like Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's what happens at the end of the book of Judges. And we're in Gideon, and in the time of Gideon, in the story of Gideon, the oppressor that comes, that the Lord sends, that the Lord gives Israel over to, is Midian, along with Amalek and other nations that are east of the Jordan River, some southeast of the Jordan River, southeast of Israel. But remember this part, that the Midians were like locusts on the ground. They come in masses with their livestock, with camels, and they just destroy everything. They strip the land, they devour the land. There's nothing left when they go through. They leave nothing in their wake, essentially. And when the Lord raised up Gideon, the Midianites, Midian, Amalek, the sons of the east, are in the Jezreel Valley. Remember, that's up here in northern Israel. That's the blue on the right side is the Sea of Galilee. On the bottom, it's the Dead Sea. So it's the northern part of Israel, the most fertile part of Israel. And it's called the breadbasket of Israel, and Midianites have moved in there. And that's the setting for where we are in Judges 7. Last week, we had the first part of Judges 7. Remember earlier than that, even before this, at the end of chapter 6, the Spirit of the Lord clothes Gideon, giving him, empowering him to be able to do things like fight battles and raise an army and make good decisions with the intent of defeating Midian. So remember that Gideon had raised 32,000 troops, and Israel, even though they would have still been outnumbered with those 32,000 troops, were preparing to go to battle against Midian, really a force that's probably more than four times that size that they were preparing to go against. So last week then, in the first 15 verses, got the title, "Nothing Can Hinder the Lord from Saving," and really part of the quote from Jonathan, Saul's son, when they're at the Battle of Michmash, and Jonathan's going to take on a bunch of Philistines with just himself and his armor bearer, and he says this: "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, by many or by few." Doesn't matter how many people that the Lord has. So from that 32,000 people then last week, we saw that the Lord said the people with you are too many to Gideon. And then he said again, the people are still too many. You still got too many. And then finally, the Lord strengthens Gideon's hand. So here's how that went. Just a few verses. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" So when that happens, the army gets reduced from 32,000 to 10,000. And then the Lord tells Gideon again, "The people are still too many." So they reduce it to, the Lord reduces it to 300, who, if you remember, lapped water in a certain way, holding it up to their hand. And by those 300 people, 300 men, the Lord would give Midian into Gideon's hand. So that's where we are. And then this, that second part, that the Lord strengthens Gideon's hand for this battle. The same night the Lord said to him, "Arise and go against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Parah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go against the camp." So you remember Gideon went down and he heard one soldier tell another soldier about a dream that he had about this loaf of bread, this kind of piece of bread that rolled down a hill and smashed a tent in the camp. And then the second soldier says, "Well, it's obvious what that means. It means this. This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp." And so Gideon is encouraged by that. And he goes back and he tells his men essentially the same thing that the Lord had told him before he was scared and went down. "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." So that's where we ended last week, and we'll start with that same verse this week. We're going to go from verse 15 in chapter 7 through verse 3 in chapter 8, and we'll keep that same title, "Nothing Can Hinder the Lord from Saving." And here are the ways we're going to break the chapter up. Gideon plans the battle in the first four verses, and then Gideon executes the plan, verses 19 through 23, and then verses 24 and into chapter 8, verse 3, Gideon changes the plan. "As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, 'Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand.' And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put trumpets into the hands of all of them, and empty jars with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, 'Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all those who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon.'" So Gideon plans the battle. "As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped." So, in the story of what's happening here, that's the thing that brings him to worship. Remember that Gideon had conversations with an angel of the Lord to start this all off. The Lord had spoken to him directly. The Lord had granted him signs that he asked for. The Lord had spoken to him at night. Gideon had asked God for more signs, and the Lord gave him those signs. And then the Lord commanded him to cut down to 300 men. And if all that weren't enough, the Lord said, and if you're still afraid, you can go down to the camp and listen to what they say. And that's where he heard the dream and the interpretation, and that's the thing that drives him to worship. All of that, and this is the one, when he goes down, here's a dream, and here's its interpretation that makes him worship. And things like that, when you see that long list of things, the Lord speaking to him, make me wonder, how many times, in how many ways, has the Lord spoken to me to drive me to worship? How many times, what have I missed? How often have I missed it? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know this. I know I'm thankful for this. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. That's from Psalm 103. And Gideon then returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand. Again, this is almost a direct quote from what the Lord says to Gideon when he reduces them down to 300 men from 10,000. Here's what it said in verse 9. That same night the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. So that continued the pattern of what we saw at the first part of chapter 7, if you remember that, which was this. The Lord told Gideon to do something, and then he just did it. He didn't answer the Lord. He just did what he said to do. He just obeyed. So this is continuing along those lines. And right before that, in chapter 6, it was the opposite. Gideon kept asking the Lord, and the Lord didn't respond, but then he did give him the signs that he was asking for. So we've got this thing where Gideon speaks to God, and God doesn't answer, but he does what he tells him to. And then the Lord speaks to Gideon, and Gideon doesn't answer, but he does what he tells him to. Back to back. End of chapter 6, beginning of chapter 7. That's the pattern we've got up to this point. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets in the hands of all of them and empty jars with torches inside the jars. So since we've been hearing frequent detailed instructions that the Lord gives to Gideon, and we don't see that here. We don't see the Lord telling Gideon how to do this, how to plan the battle. It appears then that these are Gideon's instructions, certainly clothed by the Lord, as it said at the end, toward the end of chapter 6. But the Lord has empowered him to do this. But Gideon has the plan. This is his plan. And notice he doesn't really tell his men why they're bringing trumpets along. He doesn't tell them why they have torches in jars. He just did it. So where did they get all the jars anyway? It seems strange that each of them would have a jar, and each of them would have a trumpet, and each of them would have a torch. Well, back in the earlier part of this chapter, it said this, and the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you. and give the Midianites into your hand, and let all the others go, every one to his home. So the people took provisions in their hand and their trumpets. They kept them. They kept them from when there were a lot more people. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do." So Gideon's got a plan. It's a brilliant one. He doesn't tell the men everything he's going to do. "When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout." So Gideon's plan, you can see here, is that the 300 men, broken into groups of 100, will surround this camp all at once, and they'll blow their trumpets, and they'll shout. And apparently, that will surprise the Midianites, and it will make them think that they're being surrounded by a large army. That's the theory anyway. Maybe there's some remembrance or how that dream is spread throughout the camp, and so that will aid them, the interpretation that this is no other than the sword of Gideon. And the Lord has given Midian into his hands, and so they should shout. And here's what they should shout: "For the Lord and for Gideon." But that's the plan. Here it is. We'll break into three companies. You'll each get a trumpet and a jar and a torch, and you'll do what I do. We'll all blow our trumpets, and then you'll yell really loud. Sounds good. So there's no indication again that the Lord gave Gideon this plan, other than that he equipped him to shout, to make this plan. But there's no indication that he told him to shout for the Lord and Gideon either. He just does that. So if I were one of those 300 people, 300 soldiers, I think I would have questions. The first one, and maybe the only one that matters: where are my weapons? They're going to be going against more than 100,000 men with 300. So if you really think about that, what good are any of the weapons that they had going to be? There are 300 of them against 100,000, more than 100,000. Weapons don't do you much good. But that does take a tremendous amount of faith. Gideon has gotten to the point where he's not only willing to do that, he's lining it up. He's getting others on board, and he's able to convince them. He's got great faith. They have to have it to be able to do something like that. And that really puts the statement to test. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving. With many or few, with weapons or not, nothing can hinder the Lord from saving. So next, Gideon executes the plan. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they just had set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. Then they held in their left hands torches, and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." And every man stood in his place around the camp. And all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled as far as Beth Shittah towards Zeraroth, as far as the border of Avel Meholah by Tabath. By the way, nobody really knows where those places are, but they fled there. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. Okay, so verse by verse on this section. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just set the watch. So first of all, let's talk about this watch. So have you ever noticed that in the New Testament, when you're reading along, you read things like this: and it was the third hour of the day. Or, and it was the sixth hour. Or, and it was the ninth hour. But you never read this: it was the third hour, or the sixth hour, or the ninth hour of the night. Hours are how you divide up the day. Watches are how you divide up the night. And what it actually means, the watches are when the guards would change. So in Matthew, for instance, you get this: and in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. So nights were broken into watches, again, when the guards changed. So by New Testament times, the Romans changed four times, fourth watch. So when Jesus walks on the water, it's not morning yet, but it's, well, it'd be, the way we count morning, it would be morning. But it's not there yet. It's not where there's light, but it's late. Earlier, watches were broken down into three. So what we have here is the middle watch, which normally would start about midnight. So and they had just set the watch, means they just changed the guard. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, so at midnight, when they had just set the watch. So, have you ever been in the middle of nowhere? And I mean in the middle of nowhere, like where there were absolutely zero artificial lights. There was no moon. And there was a cloud cover. Have you ever experienced that? Absolutely no lights. No lights that we provide. The moon's not out. There are enough clouds there, you can't see any stars. I think I've experienced that two times in my life, and I'm 66. Two times. I'm guessing probably most of us never have experienced something like that. But it is a completely helpless feeling. You can't really move around. You can't see anything. You can't see where you're going. You can't see where you're stepping. You can't see up. You can't see down. You can't see people. The only way you know they're people is if they're talking. You have no idea what you can do. So that is the kind of thing that is described in Exodus chapter 10, where it says this, "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness to be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the people of Israel had light where they lived." So why talk about that? Well, because I don't know what that night was like in Jezreel. I have no idea. Scripture doesn't tell us that. When Gideon surrounded them, what was it like? How were they able to do it? How were they able to get there? What were the people thinking? Was it completely dark? But I do know this, and you know this from Scripture. The Lord uses nature, what we would call nature, to win battles. He could make that night however he wanted it for them, for those 300 men that were coming up against all the Midianites. And they blew their trumpets, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. And suddenly, the Midianites heard trumpets and they saw 100 torches. Who knows how many soldiers are behind them? Then the three companies blew their trumpets and broke the jars. And there were 300 torches all around them. Who knows how many soldiers are behind those torches? Who knows how many more torches are coming? You know, when Gideon had 32,000 men, he wasn't very far away from that camp. They probably saw those 32,000 men. It would have been hard for the Midianite army to miss them. They're in a valley. Right? They're not that far away. They might not have known that earlier that day, Gideon released 31,700 of those 32,000 soldiers, but that's what happened. And by the way, then there's that dream. This is no other than the sword of Gideon. They held in their left hands the torches, and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." So Midian's dream, Midian's nightmare, really, is upon them. This is no other than the sword of Gideon, is what they said. And here, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. So let's think about that statement for a minute. So did you notice that it's slightly different from the one, two verses earlier in verse 18? In verse 18 it says, "For the Lord and for Gideon," or "For the Lord and Gideon," "For the Lord and for Gideon." It doesn't say anything about a sword. Now the sword might be because Gideon remembered the dream, the interpretation that he heard to that dream. And maybe though it's also just because of what is going to come after this. A sword of the Lord and of Gideon, as it says in King James, or a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. It could be a sword that belongs to the Lord and to Gideon. A sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Again, we're not told that the Lord told Gideon to put it this way. It appears that he's saying it on his own. It just might be. It might be only because he remembers that statement from the dream, and he wants to make sure that that's the way that Midian understands it too. But what if it is Gideon beginning to take credit for what the Lord is doing? That happens all the time. People do that all the time. And every man stood still, or stood in his place around the camp. So what that's telling us is that all the 300 men stayed where they were. They didn't panic. They didn't move. They didn't run. They just stood firm. And all the army ran. So that would be all the Midianites ran. And they cried out and they fled. And when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. The Lord doesn't need his people to have swords. The Lord can use anyone's swords for his purpose. Even his enemy's swords for his purpose. So in that sword, every sword is a sword of the Lord. In that sense, that's the way that is. Every sword is a sword of the Lord. And every sword in this battle belongs to the Lord. They turn it on each other. He doesn't need his people to outnumber the other army. The Lord can use any army. It says here that they turn their sword against every man's sword against his comrade. You could read it this way. Every man's sword against his friend. Same word. Every man's sword against his friend and against all the enemy. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving his people. With many or few, with weapons or not, nothing can hinder him. And the army fled as far as Bethshittah toward Zerah, as far as the border of Avel, Mahanalah, and Tabbath. So the Midianites, some of them apparently got out, right? They escaped. They didn't all kill each other. They started heading. They escaped, and while they don't know where these places are for sure, almost certainly they, just because of the terrain and the geography, they would have had to go east and then in southeast. They're headed back across the Jordan River. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get back across the Jordan River where they came from. They needed to go east, southeast, and so they do that. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh. And they pursued after Midian. So two questions. First one, where did all the other men come from? And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh. And they pursued after Midian. Well, if you just look back to the earlier part of the chapter, that's where, with one more, with Zebulun, I think, was also included, but Naphtali and Asher and Manasseh were included in the original 32,000 people. They probably hadn't gone too far. So probably then, that's probably where they came from. The second question. Why did Gideon call more men? Did the Lord tell him, whoops, I didn't see that coming. I guess I needed more than 300 men, right? No, that's not what happened. So is this a big deal or not? After all, if you keep reading, you'll see. As we keep reading, you'll see this was successful. This worked. It appears that calling up the additional troops worked. And isn't that a fact then? Doesn't that prove then that the Lord blessed Gideon with what he did? Daniel Block comments on this in his commentary on Judges, and it is striking. And along with, he also cites a guy named Klein right afterwards about this passage. So here's what Block says. But having achieved the divinely intended goal with the 300 core troops, Gideon appeared to forget the point of Yahweh's reduction of the troops. Instead of operating by faith and by seeking guidance from God, he relied on human strength and mobilized the troops of Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh. So Block's pretty hard on him, right? Here's what Klein said, and that Block records for or quotes here. The coward has become confident. He directs far-flung mopping up operations, which are effectively carried out. But the voice of the Lord is stilled, not to be heard for the balance of Gideon's narrative. And the Spirit of the Lord, which brought the courage to fight a far greater military force, seems to slip from Gideon's shoulders in the process. It's a turning point in the story. And what makes that so clear is that line that Klein points out. But the voice of the Lord is stilled, not to be heard for the balance of Gideon's narrative. So the Lord's been speaking to Gideon throughout, and now never again. Never again is it recorded that he spoke in Gideon, in the story of Gideon. We're in chapter 7 still. We'll be in chapter 8. Doesn't speak. The Lord doesn't speak. An angel of the Lord had conversed with him, right? The Lord had commanded him. He had talked to the Lord. He had talked to God. Gideon just obeyed what the Lord commanded him, and now he never hears it again. That's all over now. The Lord is still, but guess what? He still saves Israel. Because nothing can hinder the Lord from saving. Not when his judge goes from cowardly to confident and then confident in himself. So Gideon changes the plan. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites, capture the waters against them, as far as Beth Barah, and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Beth Barah, and also the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. Then they pursued Midian, And they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight with Midian or against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Ebenezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. Gideon changes the plan. So Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, so Gideon calls up more troops. He calls up Ephraim, which was not a part of the original 32,000 army. They were all north of here. So Manasseh is Gideon's tribe. Ephraim is south of Manasseh. The others were north of Manasseh. And Gideon is just, he's gaining enough credibility that he can call up troops from different places, like Ephraim. So the Midianites, they're just trying to get across the river, come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan. So in other words, he's calling the Ephraimites to cut them off at the pass as they cross the Jordan River. Don't let them cross the river. So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the wine press of Zeb. So those names, by the way, names are significant usually. Oreb means raven. Zeb means wolf. They show up later. I think it's in Psalms. Yeah, in Psalms they show up there as well. So this incident shows up in Psalms. Then they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. So Ephraim was successful. The Lord continued to save Ephraim, though Gideon changed the plan. Gideon called up more troops, different troops, new troops, when the Lord said he could save with 300, or he would have them save with 300. He would give them into his hands. But the Lord works with it anyway, because nothing can hinder him from saving. But there is trouble in paradise here, or better, trouble in the promised land might be better. But then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this you have done to us?" I mentioned this phrase a while back. This is always in a negative context. What is this you have done to us? What is this you have done to me? What have you done to me? What is this you have done? Things like that. Always in a negative context. What are you trying to do to me? And what had he done to them? What were they complaining about? What were they accusing him of? What did they accuse him fiercely about? "You didn't call us to fight. At the beginning, you should have called us to fight. You didn't call us to fight." That's what they were complaining about. And then Gideon answers them. "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Ebenezer?" So this means is that the gleaning of the grapes that Ephraim has is like picking up the leftover grapes after the harvest, right? So the ones that didn't get harvested, which is capturing and executing Orev and Zeev. That's what he's talking about. And the grape harvest is self-explanatory. It is what it is. It's the grape harvest. And it means what they did, the battle that they had with Midian. And Gideon is just simply telling it. Isn't it better that you got to kill Orev and Zeev than to have to fight against all the Midianites? That's a better thing for you. It's a better situation. It's better. After all, God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Orev and Zeev. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? Basically, nothing. What have I been able to do? Nothing compared to what you've done. So Gideon is not only proving to be good on the battlefield and good at making decisions on his own, he's also an excellent politician. It says, and their anger against him subsided when he said this. So imagine our political climate. Imagine if somebody could come along and it would be said of him, and their anger against him subsided when he said that. Nobody in our political climate thinks that way about their opponents. They're never going to get along. Manasseh, Gideon's tribe, Ephraim, they're right next to each other. They're actually combined. They're the tribe of Joseph. So they're the half-tribe of Manasseh and the half-tribe of Ephraim. And that half-tribe division was big. They're rivals, really. They're right next to each other, and they're rivals. At least the western part of Manasseh's territory is right north of Ephraim. And Gideon was able to unite not only them, right? Get the anger to subside, not only with them, but to raise an army from four other tribes. He's already got five tribes. He is a good politician. And how was he able to do this? In spite of all Gideon's flaws, in spite of doing the wrong thing, when God says 300, take 300, he takes 300 and then says, well, God must not have thought of this, or maybe this is what we should do. Here's why. Judges 2:18, the first part of it. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. It doesn't say this. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge as long as they remained 100% faithful to him. It says, whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. Because nothing can hinder the Lord from saving. Let's close in prayer.